We're going to be looking today at the book of Kings, the 8th chapter. If you want to follow along in the Bibles in your pews there, it looks like page 238 will get you caught up. And I'm going to be jumping around a little bit. This is an incredibly repetitious book, so rather than reading the same words over and over again, hitting, you know, verse 1, 6, 10, kind of like that, so you can follow as best you like and get lost in the rest of the text while I'm preaching during those space out moments later. So, starting at just verse 1 there. Then King Solomon summoned into his presence at Jerusalem all the elders of Israel, all the heads of the tribes and the chiefs of the Israelite families, to bring up the Ark of the Lord's Covenant from Zion, the city of David. Jumping down to 6. The priest then brought the Ark of the Lord's Covenant to its place in the inner sanctuary of the temple, the most holy place, and put it beneath the wings of the cherubim. Skipping ahead again. When the priests withdrew from the holy place, the cloud filled the temple of the Lord, and the priests could not perform their service because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled his temple. And then we're going to move down to the prayer. Then Solomon stood before the altar of the Lord in front of the whole assembly of Israel. And he spread out his hands towards heaven, and he said, O Lord, God of Israel, there's no God like you in heaven above or on the earth below. You who keep your covenant of love with your servants, you who continue wholeheartedly in your way. You've kept your promise to your servant David, my father. With your mouth you have promised, and with your hand you have fulfilled it, as it is today. And finally, jump into verse 41. This is further on in Solomon praying to God. As for the foreigner who does not belong to your people Israel, but has come from a distant land because of your name, for men will hear of your great name and your mighty hand and your outstretched arm. When he comes and prays towards this temple, then hear from heaven, your dwelling place, and do whatever the foreigner asks of you, so that all peoples of the earth may know your name and fear you, as do your own people Israel, and may they know that this house I have built bears your name. This is the word of the Lord for us today. So tell me, when you hear the name Solomon, what do you think of? Wisdom, right? It's what he's known for. Solomon the wise, given wisdom by God. Yeah. What else? Two women come before him. They both claim ownership of this baby. Who gets him, right? Yeah, very well known. Mm-hmm. Wives, yes, and many more concubines beside, right? Yeah, his great wealth, outpoured from his wisdom, wealth followed in a long life. Yeah, I think that's pretty much the answers that you get from anyone. Unless, you know, you happen to get that one special guy who wants to tell you about how King Solomon was actually the founder of the Illuminati and the one world government that secretly runs the show today. Worked in a bookstore and I had the section with all the conspiracy theory books. King Solomon was apparently a major player in all that stuff. But really, we don't have a ton of ideas and stories about Solomon. You know, I wish sometimes that the same author who recorded the stories of Samuel and Saul and David had continued on and written Solomon's biography. This is a different guy. But when you hear all these interesting stories and all the dirt that the author of Samuel puts in there about, say, David and his family, you wonder what was really going on during Solomon's time. And you wish we got more stories like his display of wisdom with a disputed baby. Or, you know, some of the tawdry details of juggling hundreds of wives and other lovers. You know, it could have been really interesting, but that's not the case. Instead, we get the Book of Kings and a historian who's much more interested in teaching basic ideas and dogmatic theology. And all that other stuff Solomon did doesn't really play in to that, so he just kind of glosses over it. And instead, we get this really dry text. You know, you look at passages like this, and it's great propaganda if you are a literate Hebrew society, because it has a very simple vocabulary, tons of repetition. It's, just grammatically structured to be very repetitive and kind of sing-song. You know, if you hear a couple verses here and there, like 23 and 24 that we read, you know, if you read the chapter, you'll read that same thing 8 more times. But it's not great literature to a modern audience. But what he's trying to get to here with all this repetition and all this focus when we read Kings is that Solomon's life didn't matter because he was wise or because he was wealthy. Solomon's life mattered only or nearly only because he was the one who built the temple in Jerusalem. This temple is hard for, I think, a modern urban audience to imagine. You know, you got to put yourself in the shoes of a pilgrim who's maybe never seen a building more than 1-2 stories tall at the most, who's been walking for days on pilgrimage, climbing this mountain of Zion up to the city of Jerusalem. And finally, after all that, after all these repetitive, low, dusty buildings, getting up to the top and seeing this. You know, I put this in because I just couldn't find an image of the temple that would actually look all that impressive. You know, it would have been something like these towers to that audience. It was huge. Almost certainly the biggest building any of those people had ever seen. And then on top of that, you start looking in the interior and every inch was covered in these most expensive possible materials. Rare hardwoods and then gold plating everything. And every bit of that gold intricately carved by master craftsmen. Beautiful art. Just an incredible amount of loving, careful labor went into trying to make this the most stunning and perfect building that culture could have imagined. And then they pile onto it. You can see faintly in the back there these massive cherubim. You know, I hear cherubim and I think of angels. And I think of angels. I'm Western, so I think of those little putty from the Renaissance, these baby angels, so soft and adorable. And I think we tend to do that with God. We can make him sort of fluffy and soft and ignore that awesomeness that we should have for something as insane and other as God. You know, these were meant to be terrifying creatures. Body of a lion, the head of a king, the wings of an eagle. They were found in other places in Scripture, guarding the tree of life in the Garden of Eden. They think that cherubim are what's represented in the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Cherubim, these four-faced beasts from Ezekiel, they're almost always protective or even divine pairs of creatures in the Scripture. They're designed to make us hang our mouths open and kind of clench our stomachs with a little bit of nerves. And that was the feeling when you walked into this room. Fear and awe. But for all of this work went into this temple, this really successful campaign to make a truly impressive building, the author of the Book of Kings really isn't all that impressed with Solomon himself. You read through it, you hear him express this kind of ambivalence. You know, yeah, he did some good stuff, but not that great of a king. mean, he married outside of the Israelite community. He apparently spent more time on his own palace than he did on this building. He was reputed to have put the northern tribes of Israel into forced labor to build this stuff, turning his own people into slaves. And he did it all with support from other pagan kings, which back in that day was not considered a good thing. So it's tough to kind of place Solomon here. He does a good thing. He's one of the great kings of Israel, but does a lot of faulty stuff too. So that's where we come into this story. That's the background. And we're here in chapter 8 for the dedication of this temple. I got thinking about these texts since last time I was here. I hadn't realized you guys had your own new building. And I was thinking about what you might have done to kind of consecrate this space. So any public space kind of needs to have, one, a reason for being, and two, almost always a dedication ceremony. There'll be a ribbon cutting, or in this case, it might have been a worship service of some sort, a time of prayer and praise to change this from just an empty building into a church. Am I on the right track there? Maybe? I'll ask you over the coffee hour. Maybe I'll get some answers then. And, you know, we can kind of take that for granted sometimes with a venerable building, but it can be a tricky thing. This actually had me thinking about the Statue of Liberty a little bit. I learned some new facts about this the other day from a lovely program called Drunk History. Maybe you are familiar with it. It's, as you might imagine from a show whose premise is get comedians very, very intoxicated and then have them teach history lessons. It is rough. It is crass, but it's also really curious. And there's one episode where a guy was talking about the bringing over the Statue of Liberty to the United States. Now, the French had put this together as a gift. They had paid for everything. And they said, all you need, America, is a place to put it. And the Congress got together and talked and said, I don't know, not worth the trouble. Thanks, but no thanks. This huge, expensive project was just going to be left to rot. And the only way that it actually got a pedestal built on Ellis Island there came because a couple of guys got together and started a letter writing campaign, and average Americans put their dollar or their quarter into an envelope, licked it shut, put on a stamp, and mailed it to this big kind of first ever Kickstarter campaign to find a place for this statue. Now, we think of it as, you know, obvious. We needed a Statue of Liberty because it's a symbol of hope. You know, it's right there in that poem, bring me your poor, your tired, your huddled masses. It's a welcome to all new immigrants to this country, foreigners entering this land, telling them, yes, this is your home. You'll be safe here. You are welcome. Well, they didn't see a need for it initially. So Solomon is trying to give the temple its purpose, to explain to people why this incredibly extensive, expensive piece of labor is necessary for Israel. So he gets together all the important players in Israel. One time, heads of the family, the priestly VIPs, puts his hands up out wide, stretched out, and he gives one of these prayers that, you know, has kind of multiple functions. Sometimes when we pray, it's not just talking to God. There's also, you know, some community announcements. You know, God, we thank you so much that we'll be able to enjoy time together as a community at the potluck after this service at 12:30 down in the basement room. You know, I don't know that God needed that level of detail, but it's in there. And you know, Solomon's going through, he's making sure to remind everyone there in his prayer that, you know, we are still the chosen people, that this temple comes from the legacy of my father, David, who was a really great king, who's also my dad. and that, you know, he is the rightful king and I am the heir to the promises God made to David. And he puts this building project as the fulfillment of all those promises God had made to David. It's very politically shrewd. Solomon is clearly the heir to Israel's story, the rightful king, the realization of David's vision and God's assurances. But some things have shifted. If you look at let's go back a second. Let's look. Here are those promises God made to David. God says, my love will never be taken away from David as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed before. Your house, your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne, and now Solomon's throne, will be established forever. Let's compare with this passage. Now, Lord, Solomon praying, God of Israel, keep for your servant David, my father, the promises you made to him when you said, you shall never fail to have a successor to sit before me on the throne of Israel. If only your descendants are careful in all they do to walk before me faithfully as you have done. Now, that's different. All of a sudden, there's a condition. Solomon is aware of this change. This is more like the covenant made with Moses. You know, when God came to Abram, he said, here's the deal. I'm going to make a nation out of you. Nothing you can do will stop this. There you go. It's a gift. With Moses and the people, it was, I will be your God, you will be my people, and you will be blessed as long as you live up to my law. If you don't, however, I will pull back my blessing, and you will suffer. So with that in mind, the temple here becomes a symbol of things being done right. God says, if you do right, it will go well with you. Well, how much better could it be than this? We're in a giant room made of gold. It's as good as it gets. This is Israel's peak in ancient history. The biggest the nation had ever been in terms of land area. David, with his busted household, took this ragged confederation of 12 different tribes. And somehow, in the midst of all these other wars between the superpowers of the era, managed to keep quiet and slowly just grab little chunks of land all around from these lesser powers. It's like, you know, when one of those little European principalities would suddenly double in size while everyone else was distracted by the Hundred Years' War. It's really clever. David was shrewd, he was charismatic, and he played things beautifully. And Israel didn't get back to this point until after the Six-Day War in 1974. This is their moment. David was a good king, he followed God, so Israel got these great gifts in return, and the temple is the manifestation of all that blessing come to fulfillment. They did well, and now well it is with them. Now, that sounds really good until we actually go back and read about David's life. We realize that David wasn't that perfect guy, right? I mean, how many of the Ten Commandments did David break right off the top of your head? And the story with Bathsheba alone, we've got, what, coveting? Watching her from the rooftops, waiting and planning to take her for his own. Got adultery when he finally got her. We've got lying when he conspired to kill her husband. We've got murder when he actually succeeded in carrying through on it. You know, David was not this perfect guy. David did not deserve to be given the greatest of gifts God could bestow, to go down in history as the greatest of all Israelite kings. But that's how he's presented here. Does. You know, the book of Job is in the Bible specifically to kind of counteract stories like this. to show how, you know, sometimes people can do good and not get good return, the same way that people can do evil and receive blessings. But again and again, especially in the American church, we seem to fail to see that. And the historian in Kings here seems to get the last laugh. We come back to this idea that if we pay strict attention to God's demands, then surely He will bless us with power and success, wealth, comfort, all that stuff, either as individuals or as the American nation. And if you've lived to adulthood, I think you know that that's baloney, right? I think you've probably known, some of you are yourself people for whom trying to live up to God's will has not led to infinite blessing, who've still had terrible things happen in their lives. You know, ultimately, it's the person of Christ who's going to be the prime example of this. Someone who fulfills the law perfectly, who follows God's will with ultimate faithfulness and is rewarded with a short life and a monstrous death. But for now, we're here in Kings 8. The Ark of the Covenant is here. It's the point of contact for that law, Moses, that contract. And in that presence, the cloud comes down on top of the mountain. It's the same image that we got when God led the people through the desert and when He rested on the tabernacle, and the same image from when the cloud came down on top of Mount Sinai when the law was given. It's a shift here. It's a big one that I imagine you've talked about with the series on Exodus you've been doing, where Israel goes from being this wandering group of nomads and becomes a nation established in a place. And that change, that cloud that came down on Mount Sinai, now coming to rest on Zion, would have been a giant symbolic thing in those days. Every god was associated with one mountain. This is Yahweh, the God of Israel, changing His address. And this is why Jerusalem still matters so much to Jews. Psalm 137, God says, "If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy." You know, Jewish men are still supposed to hear this passage read on their wedding day, so that in that context, they're reminded that whatever they're looking forward to, the highest joy in their life is Jerusalem, is God's presence with the nation. It lives on in the imagination for thousands of years after the temple's destruction by the Babylonians, the second temple's destruction at the hands of Rome. This is why they end the Passover meal every year saying, "Next year in Jerusalem, next year we'll be home." It's why the western wall of the temple is still the holiest site in Judaism. The temple is so important. And it's because of that cloud touching down. It's because it's the place where the worshiper knows that they can go and encounter God Himself. God is there. And we read in verse 27, you know, it's not like God is trapped here. But will God really dwell on earth? The heavens, even the highest heaven, can't contain you. How much less this temple I've built? But still, that's where God's name is. That's where you can get closest. It's this neat conjoining of these two ideas they call immanence and transcendence. Immanence means God is close to us as our skin, that He's right here. And the temple was immanence. You could walk up, and out of all of the places you could go on earth, this is the one where God stepped a foot down and put Himself in the dirt among the people. But it's also a place to call prayers from all over the world. And transcendence means God is so far beyond. He's other. He's ineffable. He's out there in the cosmos, outside of time and space. And the temple calls to people across all of those gaps. So prayer, no matter where on earth it might come from, can reach across all of that distance and reach the temple. And in the temple, God has come down and it can get to him. He hears. This is all setting up, in some ways, the sermon we're going to preach next Sunday about that temple in later days and God's real presence made known again in that same space through the person of Jesus. But for the moment, we're going to set aside that story. Instead, I want to look at what the last part of this passage yet. We get to the end here, and all of Solomon's dedication is leading to this extended prayer for forgiveness. He steps away from all this political jargon about, David's kingship and his role, and stops to ask God seven times to forgive people when they fall short of that law of Moses. It's kind of a jumpy transition, but it's a sign, I think, that the author had more than just some simplistic and demonstrably false idea about good acts begetting good blessings and evil ones bringing punishment. We read this and we can think about David breaking all those commandments and see that one of the last people that God should have given unbreakable, infinite love received it anyway, even in his brokenness. The covenant sets up a statement on sin and our fallen nature as sinful people, and we are. I am. And I, just like you guys, need something to make me right with God, or else I'm going to bear the consequences of that. And all that sets up 2,000 years in our past, 500 years in Solomon's future, that moment when God came down and was reborn on this earth, lived a life, died, came back to life, and preceded us into heaven. That gives us hope as Christians in times of despair, which is unreal. But it's also something that we can take for granted because it's been that way for a couple millennia now. God's promises have been for Christians anywhere who want to come to God. And that's why I want to highlight this final part, just this one little moment of begging for forgiveness. It's in verses 41 to 43 there. As for the foreigner who does not belong to your people, Israel, who's come from a distant land because of your name, for men will hear your great name, know of your mighty hand and your outstretched arm. When he comes and prays towards this temple, then hear from heaven your dwelling place and do whatever the foreigner asks of you. This is an amazing claim in the context of 7th century BCE Israel. It's for people who'd lived alongside foreigners their whole lives and clashed with them repeatedly. The readers will have, by the time this book is really being circulated, will have heard about the destruction of the northern kingdom by foreigners, about the Samaritans who were nearly wiped out, and how Assyrian elements had ceded the region, how they tried to wipe out Judah and Jerusalem already and only failed due to some good luck on Judah's part. So there's no good reason for Solomon or anyone else who was in the temple that day to think any kind words about a foreigner. Israel was special. The whole point was to be different from these other nations. And yet Solomon takes a moment to pray specifically for them, that this will be an open place for all to worship. the author is taking a moment to challenge anyone who would exclude strangers or the foreigners, even now in their midst, demanding a place at the table of God. Without them, Solomon prays, we lose the wideness of God's mercy. He says, you know, all of us, like David, need that amazing mercy of God if we're going to be his friends, his children. We need openness to those who are different if we want to experience that fully for ourselves. So Solomon has built this place where those who would come to pray to the God of everywhere, wherever and whoever they might be, could come and stand in that place, the very place where God touched down on earth. This stipulation about foreigners precedes a lot of conflict in later years over who would be allowed to come and join the community of Israel. And that future conflict, including one in the court of the Gentiles, is what we're going to look at next week. And so I'm going to give you some homework for then. I'm going to be here next week, and I'm going to ask you, whom is the foreigner today? By that, I don't mean, you know, just nationality-wise. I asked, trying to think about this, a couple of my old youth group kids who live up in this battleground Vancouver area, you know, who in the context of this story would be the foreigners, you know, in your neighborhood? And the first told me, oh, well, it'd be the Mormons, I guess. And they said, no, actually, no, we'd be the foreigners to the Mormons. They're the majority there. And another one of them said, well, maybe some of the Hispanic folks who come through and do work in the migrant community. And they had some different ideas, and they got really uncomfortable labeling anyone that way. So I want to recast this instead as, whom is it that could walk, or who is it that would walk through that door next Sunday morning that would make you uncomfortable as a worshiping body? Who could come into this place and divide you? Who could walk in that door and say, I want to take part in the church service, that would make you say, I don't know if you should be here? What about their identity could push you that way? What could they have done or be doing? It's a strange way to think, because we're so quick to say, oh, you know, we're a church, we want to welcome everyone. But I think most communities, if you really stop and ponder, have some folks that could set your teeth on edge a bit. But I don't want to leave you there this morning. So take that homework home. But for now, I want to highlight one little detail that actually came from the chapter before this one. In the building account of the temple, there's this extended chapter talking about the building of the entryway. And a guy wrote a book a couple years ago that highlighted one little piece of it, these two pillars that stood in the doorway. And it goes on and on about the chain links and how they were fashioned all around here. And there's just one little throwaway line about the pomegranates, which probably can't make out, they're right here, and how there's 200 of them, and they've been hand-carved out of gold with the minutest detail and set in place all the way around here. And this guy, I'm blanking on his name right now, but in discussing this, he points out how these pillars are 30 feet tall, and there's 100 other things to look at when you walk into the temple. And on top of that, there's this little, you know, pedestal beneath it, which is going to block your view, even if you wanted to look at them from this distance, and you'd never be able to see all the delicate little detail. And yet, the craftsman who was working on these things still took the time to put scrupulous care into each individual pomegranate. He said, you know, it can't possibly have been for the benefit of anyone other than God. Because no one else is ever going to notice these things. You know, that passage isn't in the lectionary. We never talk about it. We only know from this footnote that these things even exist. He said, this is just an incredible image of somebody responding to that message of forgiveness. Not, you know, doing work because he's scared or because he's trying to make up for something, for his sins. This is just an act of love out of gratitude to the God who welcomed in foreigners like this craftsman to his temple. It's a really neat image, and I love it. This is a guy who loves God with his whole heart, as the text today said. We think of loving someone with our heart, you know, as being something we do out of, you know, the mushy emotional centers of ourselves, right? That's what our heart is. In the Hebrew anthropology, the heart was where your will came from and where your mindset. And so the center of will and intelligence is what drives our connection to God. So when we invite you to go out of this place today and love God and serve Him with your whole heart, it's with a single-minded devotion and the kind of care that could lead you to spend how many months of your life carving little golden pomegranates just to say, yes, God, thank you. Bring us back to you.